It's Sunday, March 22nd, and welcome to Higher IQ. Hope you're having a great weekend. Ever wonder why? Not why it's great, why it's a weekend at all. Turns out, the 2 days off you're enjoying right now exist because of a religious negotiation, a hungover workforce, and a car manufacturer who realized people can't buy things if they never stop working. For most of human history, nobody had a weekend. Work followed seasons, daylight, and necessity. Farmers worked when the land demanded it. Artisans worked until the order was done. The idea of a fixed schedule with designated days off is barely 100 years old. Before the Industrial Revolution, the rhythm of work was irregular but self-directed. You worked hard for a stretch, then you didn't. Fairs, festivals, and religious holidays broke up the calendar. In medieval England, there were as many as 40 to 50 Saints' Day holidays per year, not counting Sundays. People weren't clocking in, they were working in bursts and resting when the work was finished or the church said to stop. Then factories, suddenly, work wasn't seasonal, it was constant. Machines didn't care about saints' days. The early Industrial Revolution demanded 10, 12, sometimes 16-hour days, 6 days a week. Domestic cooks in late 1800s Massachusetts were logging 78 to 83 hours a week for about 9 cents an hour. Sunday was the only day off, and that was a religious mandate, not a labor one. But workers adapted in ways their employers didn't love. Enter Saint Monday. Starting in the 1700s, British artisans and laborers developed a tradition of simply not showing up on Mondays. The pattern was predictable. Sunday was your one day off, so you drank. Monday, you were too wrecked to work. The practice became so widespread it got its own name, a sarcastic reference to the religious holidays that were the only other excuse for missing work. An 1830s French print titled Le Grand Saint Lundi, Patron Saint of Drinkers, showed Saint Monday presiding over a scene of artisan revelry like an industrial age Dionysus. By the mid-1800s, Saint Monday was a full-blown cultural institution. Music halls and theaters in London scheduled their best entertainment on Mondays because they knew the working class would be there instead of at the factory. Workers would burn through their Saturday wages on Sunday, stagger through Monday, and start ramping up productivity by Tuesday or Wednesday before a frantic push to finish the week's orders by Saturday night. Employers hated it. Temperance campaigners hated it. And both groups landed on the same solution, though for different reasons. What if you gave workers Saturday afternoon off instead? The logic was straightforward. If workers had a legitimate half day on Saturday for errands, shopping, and what Victorian reformers called rational recreation, maybe they'd stop drinking themselves into oblivion on Sunday and actually show up on Monday. The Early Closing Association, formed in 1842, lobbied manufacturers across England's industrial towns. Their pitch wasn't compassion, it was productivity. Give them Saturday, and you get Monday back. It worked. The 1867 Factory Act formalized Saturday half days, and by the 1890s, the half day off had become the anchor for a new kind of working class culture. Football matches moved to Saturday afternoons. The football craze, as the press called it, took off right as the new working week was starting to take shape. Shopping shifted to Saturday evenings. The modern weekend didn't start as a right. It started as a bargain between bosses who wanted reliable Monday attendance and reformers who wanted sober workers. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, the two-day weekend had a completely different origin. In 1908, a New England cotton mill became the first American factory to give workers 5 days instead of six. The reason had nothing to do with hangovers or temperance. The mill employed a large number of Jewish workers who observed the Sabbath from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown, which meant they couldn't work Saturdays. But Christian workers expected Sunday off. The mill's solution was to close on both days. A Jewish Daily Bulletin headline later joked that Orthodox Jews and Henry Ford agree on one point. Because by the 1920s, the most famous industrialist in America had picked up the idea and scaled it. Henry Ford announced the 5-day, 40-hour workweek at Ford Motor Company in 1926. Edsel Ford, his son, told the press that every man needs more than 1 day a week for rest and recreation. But Ford's reasoning wasn't altruistic. He had developed an economic philosophy that historians now call Fordism. The core insight was almost circular. Mass production requires mass consumption. If your workers never stop working, they never buy anything. Ford wanted his employees well-paid and well-rested so they'd spend money on leisure, ideally on his cars. This wasn't Ford's first experiment in engineering worker behavior. In 1914, he introduced the $5 day at his Highland Park plant, roughly double the going rate. The context matters. Ford's assembly line had made production radically faster and cheaper. But the work was so repetitive and physically brutal that labor turnover hit 380% in a single year. Nobody wanted to stay. The $5 day was a retention strategy disguised as generosity, and it came with strings. Workers had to submit to inspections by Ford's sociological department, which sent investigators to employees' homes to check whether they were drinking, saving enough money, or keeping a clean house. Workers who failed the inspection didn't get the bonus. The five-day week in 1926 was the same logic extended further. Ford wasn't liberating workers. He was engineering consumers. But it worked so well that other companies followed. Samuel Gompers, head of the American Federation of Labor, said Ford's plan would prove as beneficial as the introduction of the 8-hour day, both as to quality and quantity of output. And when the Great Depression hit in 1929, shorter hours became an economic strategy. If fewer people could find full-time work, spreading the available hours across more workers seemed like a way to reduce unemployment. Kellogg's, the cereal company, switched to 6-hour shifts in 1930 and kept them for nearly 2 decades. Workers used the extra time to garden, play sports, and participate in community organizations. The company found that productivity per hour actually increased. By 1938, Franklin Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which capped the workweek at 44 hours with mandatory overtime pay for anything beyond that. Frances Perkins, the Secretary of Labor and the first woman in a presidential cabinet, was the driving force behind the legislation. 2 years later, the cap dropped to 40 hours. The 5-day 40-hour workweek was now federal law. It hasn't changed since. The number 40 has been the legal standard for 86 years, which is why the 4-day workweek conversation is so interesting. Iceland ran the largest trial between 2015 and 2019, covering 2,500 public sector workers. They cut hours from 40 to 35 or 36 with no pay reduction. The results: productivity stayed the same or improved, stress and burnout dropped, and workers reported better balance between their jobs and their personal lives. By 2024, roughly 86% of Iceland's workforce had either moved to shorter hours or gained the right to do so. Iceland's GDP growth hit 4.1% in 2023, above the European and OECD average. The UK ran its own trial in 2022 across 61 companies. Of those, 56 continued with the 4-day week after the trial ended. Revenue stayed flat or grew. Sick days fell. Staff turnover dropped by 57%. The arguments against it sound exactly like the arguments against the 5-day week in 1926. The New York Herald scoffed at Ford's plan as joyous news to all who like to think of bringing work down to the irresistible minimum. Business leaders warned it would destroy productivity. 100 years later, the data from Iceland, the UK, and a growing list of companies says the opposite. The pattern is always the same. Workers push for fewer hours. Employers resist. Someone runs the experiment. Productivity doesn't collapse. The new schedule becomes normal. Then everyone forgets it was ever controversial. We went through it with the 10-hour day, the 8-hour day, the 5-day week, and the 40-hour cap. Every single time, the people arguing that shorter hours would ruin the economy turned out to be wrong. So if this comes up in conversation, here's how to think about it. The weekend wasn't given to you. It was negotiated. A religious accommodation in a New England mill. A hangover cure rebranded as moral reform. A car manufacturer who figured out that tired people don't go shopping. And a federal law that hasn't been updated since 1940. You've been living inside a labor compromise that's almost a century old, and the only question now is whether the next version takes another 100 years or not. Stay informed, stay curious, and we'll see you tomorrow.